Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. This is Peter Schiff with another live episode of Wall Street Unspun, a midweek market update. We're going to be taking your calls live at 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. I got to let you guys know right now, my brother Andy Schiff will be filling in, taking the calls live. I can only stay for a short while. I actually am in New York City. I am here at a political function that my people tell me there are some good connections here, and I'm trying to get to work on the campaign. As I stand here, Martha Stewart just walked in front of me into the event. So I guess there are some interesting people here that I can meet and network with that potentially can help me. We're still trying to wrestle the campaign team up together. Hopefully we'll be, you know, kind of launching full force into the campaign within a couple of weeks. Anyway, going to the markets, the U.S. dollar today hit another new low for the year. The dollar index actually cracked below the 75 handle, closed right on the low of the day. I think it closed back above 75, but it traded in the 74s. All the main currencies hit 52-week highs. The Swiss franc almost trading over a dollar at about 99.5 cents. It's about a record high for the Swiss franc. Dollar, euro, all hit 52-week highs today. The euro is now trading over $1.50. Gold, you know, gold still trading above 1,050, 1,060 the ounce. Oil continues to move higher. I've been talking about oil on this show and on my blog. Oil closed up around $82 a barrel on the back of the weak dollar. You know, the story is the same. You know, it's interesting. You know, I was on CNBC Fast Money today. I had been on about 10 days earlier. And again, you know, the market is going up, and the panel is accusing me of getting it wrong because I was bearish on the economy and the markets. And I tried to point out, you know, that I'm not bearish on all markets. I'm bullish on foreign markets. In fact, when I was on that show, specifically asked me for two stock recommendations, and in less than 2 weeks, those stocks are up about 20% each compared to the 3% gain in the S&P. And I tried to point out that the real gains are happening abroad, especially when you factor in currency translations. And, you know, they also tried to belittle the move in gold by saying that, you know, gold is only up about 20% on the year. But what I, you know, didn't have a chance to point out on the air was that that's because gold didn't fall nearly as much as the stock market in 2008. I mean, if you look at where gold is, it's at record highs. The U.S. stock market is far from a record high. I mean, it needs to rally over 30% to get, maybe 35% to get back up into nominal record high territory. You know, it's sometimes it's very difficult to get credit from a lot of these guys. You know, speaking about, you know, getting credit, you know, if you haven't picked up a copy of Crash Proof 2.0, remember that that's on sale. That is not a brand new book. It is a revised version of my original book. There are 80 new...
Peter's cut off.
But for some reason, people are buying it, and, you know, sometimes they don't realize that. They think they're getting a new book. I saw another review on Amazon where somebody wanted to return it because there were only 80 new pages. I mean, I think there are 80 good pages. It's about 25% more book, but I think it's worth getting. And certainly if you've never read the book, you definitely want to get it. But the reason I wanted to update it is that book is 3 years old, and it's still selling, it's still on the shelves, and I wanted to have it more current to reflect a lot of the things that have happened since the book first came out. But it's interesting, one of their, there was somebody put up a one-star review on there, and yes, I'm learning some things, but don't follow my advice because my advice is wrong. Everything that I said happened the opposite, that my clients have lost all their money, which we know isn't true. And he criticized me. The review said, well, Peter Schiff said the dollar was going to go down and it went up, and Peter said gold was going to go up and it went down. Well, I just, you know, I just finished pointing out that gold's at a record high, the dollar's making new 52-week lows. When I wrote Crash Proof initially, the dollar index was above 85.
Perhaps Peter is cutting off there. You don't have a cell phone, so until I start hearing talking again, maybe I can perhaps finish his point. This is Andrew, in case you didn't sense the change in tone. And just to pick up where Peter left off, he was talking about the dollar. Yeah, I mean it's making 52-week highs, and of course the kind of reputation that we had for getting it wrong. He was talking about that post on the review of Crash Proof 2.0, and this is an unfortunate seed that got planted. There was a Wall Street Journal article that came out, I think about early January.
Okay, so. Andy, I'm back. Anyway,
okay.
Obviously, I'm on a cell phone here outside of the Pierre Hotel, so, New York cell phone service is lousy, unfortunately. But anyway, as I was saying, when I wrote Crash Proof initially, gold was under $700 an ounce. The dollar index was over 85. We've fallen substantially in the dollar. We've risen a lot in gold, yet people are trying to criticize me for being wrong on the dollar and gold. I mean, obviously, there was a small rally or a large rally in the dollar in the second half of 2008 and a drop in the price of gold, but, Crash Proof was not about 2008. It was about the big picture. It was about over the long term. In fact, in the book, I specifically talk about the fact that you're always going to have bear market rallies in the dollar or bull market declines in gold. Nothing is a straight line up. You can't simply just look at one short period of time where the dollar actually strengthened and say, aha, Peter Schiff was wrong. Here's a six-month period where the dollar went up. You got to look at the big picture. It's just amazing that somebody can write a review like that a few days ago when the dollar is making new lows and gold is making new highs. But again, what does this mean? Why is this happening? I was watching a discussion of the weak dollar, and the dollar is making a lot of news now. There's a lot of stories. People are talking about the weak dollar. Very few people seem to appreciate just what it means for the average American, for the average American standard of living, for the value of our savings, for the value of our wages. That's going to sink in eventually. But you have a lot of people who who want a stronger dollar and want the U.S. government to pursue policies to promote a strong dollar. Unfortunately, they can't do that. They think that pursuing a strong dollar is just about talking about how you want a strong dollar, or maybe raising interest rates from zero up to 0.5% or 1%. That's not going to do it. We can't just talk about a strong dollar. We need real action. We need to shrink the money supply. We need the Federal Reserve to sell, not buy, a Treasury debt, to sell, not buy, mortgage-backed securities and asset-backed securities. We need dramatically higher interest rates. We need to withdraw all the stimulus right now, and we need to let the phony bubble economy. But even if we do that, we're going to initially maybe get a little bump in the dollar, but then the dollar is going to fall because the dollar still has to go down, unfortunately, to reflect all of our lost productivity and output and all the problems and all the mistakes that we've made in the past that unfortunately are going to result in a diminished standard of living and a lower dollar. But at least if we do the right thing, if we do the right thing now, if we swallow the tough medicine, the dollar will stop falling eventually and one day recover and strengthen again. But if we keep doing what we're doing now, there's no bottom in sight for the dollar. It'll just keep falling and falling and losing more and more value, not only because of all the mistakes of the past, but because of the mistakes that we're making right now and because of all the mistakes that we're threatening to make in the future. Now you're seeing, some of the stimulus run out as far as the subsidy for new home buyers where you get a tax credit and the real estate industry is pressuring. And we need to extend the credit or the real estate market is going to implode. We need to keep finding artificial ways to get people to buy things that they really can't afford. It shows that all they're trying to do is blow air into a busted bubble. It's impossible to do, but the political pressure is there to continue to do that. Now, we'll see what happens. The bond market was very, very weak today. I don't know if that was because of the weakness in the dollar or if it was just a one-day event. But eventually, we need to see, or we will see, a weakness in the dollar translating into weakness in the bond market. That hasn't really happened thus far. And I think as long as the weak dollar isn't causing a substantial increase in interest rates, it doesn't seem that the government or anybody on Wall Street is really worried about it. To the extent that we do get higher interest rates as a result of the weak dollar, which we will eventually, then maybe there'll be a little bit more problem for the U.S. stock market, and maybe the government will feel that they have to talk a little bit more about trying to find ways to talk the dollar up. I know we already have other foreign central banks, even though they're talking tough on the need for interest rates. You have other foreign banks that are still trying to talk up the dollar. Look what Brazil did the other day. They imposed a 2% transaction tax on foreigners who want to buy Brazilian shares in an effort to stem the advance of the Brazilian real, which is up about 35% this year. And that's despite the fact that Brazil has been accumulating dollar reserves. They now have upwards of $200 billion in reserves. That's just Brazil. That's about four times the total foreign exchange reserve of the United States. And that's just Brazil. That's just one emerging market. So this is happening all around the world. But ultimately, I think these foreign governments are going to, you know, come to their senses and reverse this policy. And that is when we are in for some serious, serious trouble, because then, of course, we're on our own. It's just the American printing presses that are going to be running a full board if we want to try to finance the deficits and the stimulus and the bailouts and all the stuff that's going on. But anyway, at that, I just wanted to open up the show and say hi to everybody. Let me turn it over to my brother, Andy, who will be able to wrap up the show and be here to answer your telephone calls throughout the rest of the hour. I will be back, and I'm sure, next Wednesday for another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. In the meantime, if you haven't, make sure to tune in to the video blog that I've been doing several times a week, and that's another way that I can touch base with everybody if you're looking to get my take on things between the weekly radio shows. Anyway, that's it for tonight. Andy, why don't you take it from here?
Okay, I will. And this is actually, Peter calls me Andy, of course, because we grew up together, but here at the company, I'm generally known as Andrew. So if you ask for a call, if you want to speak to me, ask for Andrew Schiff, and they'll put you through. So, and I also just want to, you know, apologize for, you know, Peter probably making fewer appearances than Wall Street Unspun today, obviously 15 minutes and dealing with spotty cell phone service. Hope you guys understand out there that, you know, he's running for Senate, and we're dealing with a campaign staff that we've just hired and who are really asking for Peter's time to focus on that campaign. It's not an easy thing. It's a full-time job. He's got to meet 1,000 people. Even though Connecticut's a small state, it's got a lot of people. He's got to bone up on some local issues. He's got to be able to, you know, really get into a room with people who, you know, have a knowledge of a lot of local issues, and he has to know what he's talking about. So he's doing that. As a result, we're scheduling fewer Euro Pacific Capital events for Peter. You know, at least through the election. I mean, we'll see what happens after the election. Hopefully he wins. But for the next 8 or 9 months, we're going to have to deal with a little bit less Peter. And I think hopefully everyone out there can deal with that. But he'll do what he can, of course, to maintain the connection with our clients and our listeners. Anyway, I just want to talk a little bit, Peter, about the strong dollar. You know, you got to think about the administration is going to talk up the strong dollar, but as long as they can get away with a situation of relatively low interest rates, and interest rates spike a little bit today, but it's still relatively low, and relatively low inflation, and relatively modest, for instance, gas prices at the pump, you know, there's going to be no political backlash for the dollar melting away. People like investors will talk about it, we'll say it gets hurting our investment accounts and so forth, but no one's really, it's not going to be a public riot if the dollar continues just to drip away. So they're going to try to avoid all the difficult things that Peter mentioned we have to do to strengthen the dollar, as long as they can get away with it politically. Now, of course, what would have to happen, you know, violent movements in the dollar would clearly, you know, indicate to Peter that people that, oh my God, this is serious. I'm paying $10 for a bag of carrots. I can't live this way, even, and I can't get a job, and my income is falling. But until that happens, and it certainly might, they're going to get away with it. So they'll talk all they want about the strong dollar, but they're not going to put in any policies that will actually make a change. And just talk a little bit more about the trajectory of where the dollar has gone over the past year. You know, I mentioned earlier this Wall Street Journal piece that came out precisely at probably February 1, 08, January 30th, 08, something like that. It was called, I think the headline of the piece was, you know, right call, wrong strategy or something like that. And it talked about, isn't it ironic, Peter Schiff, the guy who was kind of known as getting this economic crash right by predicting the housing crisis and predicting the economic crisis, too bad he made mincemeat out of his clients. And that piece, you know, has just had a life of its own and is really, you know, almost stamped a big, you know, loser on Peter's forehead in a lot of ways, unless to some people. But, you know, when you think about it, that piece came out precisely at our low watermark. I mean, if I had to put a pin on a calendar that said, like, when were our clients doing the worst, it would have been pretty much at that period. If you look since then, of course, you know, there's been huge rallies in not just the U.S. stock market, but the global stock markets. And as Peter mentioned today on Fast Money on CNBC, the rallies overseas have been huge. You got to add to that, certainly much bigger than we've had here, this type of stocks that we generally like, you know, a lot of metal stocks, precious metal stocks, agricultural stocks, energy stocks. They've rallied even bigger. Of course, their fall was kind of bigger, but their rally has been bigger. And then you add into that the rally in the U.S. dollar, 30% against the Aussie dollar. The Aussie dollar is 30%. The Canadian dollar about 20. The euro about 20. You add to that, and we've had a great, great run. So at this point, if you look at where we are versus 2 years ago before the this whole crisis began, it certainly does look like it was the right call and the right strategy. And we think that we're getting vindicated, but of course, you know, it's hard to create that first impression. And when you look at guys like on CNBC today, Peter's been on that show, Fast Money, seven or eight times in the past month. They know what we like. They know we like foreign stocks. As I said, Peter gave them those foreign stocks, all of which have done pretty well. And still, they say, but Peter, you're a bear. You're missing in all this great stuff. They don't get it. I mean, it's incredible. It makes me crazy that these people simply don't understand our strategy. He's been on the show five times. These guys are professionals. So you can imagine the impression that we get from the casual observer. So, but anyway, if you look at the trajectory of the dollar, you know, it's interesting that when the crisis started, of course, back in, let's say, September of 08, the dollar just rallied, and the high water mark for the dollar was about March 09. So it went from the trough to the peak. The U.S. dollar did, the U.S. dollar index from September or October to March. It was 6 months, and now it's come full circle. It's down almost to the exact levels that it was a year ago, September of 08, and it's the exact same 6 months. So it's an extremely symmetrical chart if you look at the dollar index. And of course, a lot of my clients ask me, I'm so concerned that people think maybe there's another correction out there, not just in U.S. stocks, but in global stocks. You know, won't the same thing happen? Won't if we get a 10% correction, won't the dollar spike up again? You know, and that's certainly a possibility. But you got to think, like, what happened last year? Why did the dollar spike up? Did people really believe in the recovery of the United States, that it was a better economy? No, people were just running for safety. There was a crash. There was a credit crunch. No one knew where to go. They went to the most liquid thing they could find. They sold riskier or perceived riskier assets, and they piled into U.S. treasuries and piled into U.S. dollars. And that caused a spike. As soon as it looked like the coast was clear, they left because they understand the fundamentals haven't changed. So the dollar just, you know, started selling off and get to the point where we've gone full circle. So the question is, if the same type of thing happens again, will the same reaction happen? And, you know, I don't think so, because I think that there's a much better understanding of where we stand economically now than there was 12 months ago. I think there's much less confidence in the United States. There's much less confidence in the future of the dollar. There's much more confidence in some of these emerging economies. And the stability of places like the Eurozone and China and the Pacific economy. So I don't think the same. We have much more debt now than we had last year. So I don't think the same dynamics will apply. So I don't. That's all I'm going to say on that. Anyway, just to move on quickly to some of the news of the day that I wanted to talk about. I thought are interesting stories. First of all, probably the top news is that and I think this is kind of funny with the Pazar. That's the Pazar, maybe the Mullah Maharaja, whatever you want to call it. Today announced that the banks receiving the TARP money, there will be pay cuts or 50% pay cuts mandated for the top 25 employees of each of those banks. Pretty stern measures, but you know, just like any other government program, you think about it. You know, how are they going to administer this? I mean, you can think about the machinations that companies do to comply with very strange regulations. So just to think for yourself, imagine if you're the number 26 employee The top 25 guys get their pay cut in half. Well, now number 26 is number one. Then does he get cut? Or does 26 then become number one? In which case, could you imagine what's going to have to happen before everyone wants to be number 26? And I'm sure they'll come up with weird ways why the guys with all the power are not going to be, are going to be 26. Like, they'll set up somebody to be number one, pay cut. So I just can't imagine how this is going to play out. But it's going to be entertaining. Of course, the government should not be in the business of regulating pay unless they happen to own the company that they're regulating. In this case, they essentially own these companies because they bailed them out. So we don't have a huge problem with governments regulating pay at those types of companies they own. We have a huge problem getting involved in the first place. So it's just kind of comical, and we'll see how this plays out. Other big news that I think that's worth talking about is, and this is a story that I've been talking to reporters for the past couple of days about, and it's unfortunate that they're not as interested as I would like, or I would think they would be. And that has to do with the student loan market and the college tuition market. And this is a little bit off subject, but it clearly illustrates some of the points that Peter talks about every week, very clearly. And that is that yesterday, the college tuition figures were announced, and it showed that in the last 12 months, private and public institutions, two-year and four-year, the costs went up again, as they have pretty much every year, in pretty much the same range they've gone up every year, which is about 5.5% to 6.5%, depending on what kind of institution you're talking about. Now, that's really odd, because the prices for just about everything else are falling in this recession. I think we think they're not falling as much as the government likes, and certainly they would have fallen a lot more if there wasn't so much inflation or money creation in the economy. But while everything else is falling, tuitions are still going up. And everyone's scratching their heads. Why is that? How can tuitions be going up? How can we afford this? At the same time, yesterday, some reports came out about the student loan market that showed that private lenders have essentially exited the market. I mean, over 2 years, they're down 80%. Severely cut back how much private lenders are lending to students. At the same time, the government, of course, is increasing their participation in the market to the point where they're now providing about 80% of the funding into the student loan market. So our contention, and what I talked about with reporters over the last couple of days, and no one really did, is like this connection couldn't be clearer. The reason why student and college tuitions aren't coming down is because government is giving money to people to go to school. They're providing, people can pay. It's insulated from the rest of the economy because the money is available for students to bid up the cost of college tuitions. And they normally, if the government weren't providing the money, students couldn't get the loans. They couldn't afford to pay the kind of tuition that they're paying. And then the universities would have to make a choice. Either they were going to let enrollment fall and not essentially do their job and educate people, or they would cut, they would scale back tuitions to the point that people could afford it. Now, I don't think, based on what I know about universities, that they're really hurting for money. I mean, the endowments are still huge. You go to a university, you can see money all over the place in terms of equipment and facilities. I think they have gotten used to this money. The money's available. They've padded their budgets. They put on a lot of big bells and whistles, and they've made it very expensive for students to go to college because they can. It's a very rational decision given there's so much money coming from the federal government. And again, the government itself doesn't really care about the loans they make because if they default, it's the taxpayers' problem. Meanwhile, these programs which were designed to make the college affordable have conspired to make college unaffordable. And of course, it hasn't really helped out the students because now all the students get out of these programs is the prize of graduating with $120,000 worth of student loan debt. It's the same exact dynamic that allowed housing prices to go up and up and up and be insulated from the underlying economics. With Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the FHA, government was making loans into the housing market and not worrying about losses and making loans that private institutions wouldn't make, which allowed the home prices to get bid up and up and up and up. And, of course, what's going to happen with the student loans right now is people are going to say, oh, my God, look how expensive it is. We're going to have to expand the student lending even further so people can go to school. And they will, and then prices will go up. And the carousel is never going to stop spinning until the government says, you know what, we're part of the problem. We're creating the problem. If you stack up these industries where government is making loans, like housing and education against everything else, you can see the graphs. They speak for themselves. Yet somehow people don't make these connections. And I'm sure they're not going to make the connections now. And it shows you what kind of consequences happen when government gets involved. You know, I can make other analogies, but it's really not worth it. Anyhow, I also like to talk about, there's another interesting, I would recommend that you take a look at it, testimony by Neil Barofsky, who is formerly involved in TARP, who testified before Congress today talking about just how little the government understands about how much the TARP's going to cost, where the money went, what the unintended consequences of the moral hazard are going to be. It's very interesting, and I think, you know, as heartfelt a testimony you're going to find from a former government official. And it just shows you how badly people conceived of the whole TARP program, and even to this day, how it went. That's about it. I think we've covered the basics. I'm going to go to we have another half hour of the show, so I'll go to the phone, and I'll take the guy who's been on hold the longest, which will be, looks like, the winner, the Denver call, Denver from Texas. You're on.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going pretty well.
Can you hear me? I have this little back.
Beat. Yeah, I can hear you. I can hear you, Denver. Okay. So you're Denver from Texas. I hope Texas from Denver's not calling, too.
I just have a small comment real quick before I got to my question about the college tuition. Peter in Crashproof, the way he explained the bubble with the housing market, and how it was actually a smaller bubble inside a bigger bubble, it seems like that's, like you were just saying, you know, sort of the same thing happening there. And I think it's also, just like Wall Street, you know, a lot of greed here in Texas. I mean, the University of Texas has oil fields specifically where the money from them goes to them and A&M. And, you know, the football stuff is just the tip of the iceberg. They have defense contracts and all kinds of stuff, so...
Yeah,
it's funny when they know what to do with. So
I mean, nobody can say that colleges are hurting. Certainly, private colleges aren't hurting. I mean, public colleges are a little bit more. But I mean, if you go walk to any campus now, you can see amazing, facilities. You can see state-of-the-art healthcare. You can see state-of-the-art pretty much everything. And then you look at their endowments. I mean, Harvard University is sitting on $50 billion. I mean, most of these private colleges have multi-billion-dollar endowments.
Right.
And is the education any better? I mean, my dad, Peter likes to tell the story. My dad loves to tell the story, and that everyone's parents had similar stories. I mean, my dad paid, I think it was $1,000 a year to go to college, and he went to the University of Connecticut. And he worked every summer as a waiter in the Catskills, as a waiter, and it took him 8 weeks, and he made $1,000 or close to it. And he was able to use that money to pay for his school all year. That was it. An 18-year-old could work for the summer and pay for college. Now, I'd imagine that University of Connecticut in the 1950s had none of the bells and whistles that a lot of the universities have today. It's probably a much more bare-bones experience. But did my father get a good education? I mean, he might argue with you, because his economics education, he would say, is very bad. But I'm sure it was better than what we get today. But that was before the government loan programs really existed. And basically, the university system evolved to the point where its target consumer, the target customer, could afford it. Now, could you imagine an 18-year-old trying to work, and make even a public school, which costs, I think, $12,000 on average over the summer, make $12,000? I mean, forget it. They're lucky to make two or three. A private college, forget it. So, it's completely out of whack to what people can afford. And it's only because of the government getting involved.
Most people I know that are, in university, they're taking on loans themselves, and then their parents are taking on loans to facilitate kids not having to work, or, they're
right.
Working 40 hours, but that's still not enough for living and everything, so they're having to pull out all the...
And who benefits primarily the universities, and also, but they're getting out of the business, the financial institutions that were initiating the loans and then selling them to Sallie Mae, just like the securitizers were doing during the housing crisis, they're making the money because of the riskless fees, because they would make the loan and then get out of it.
Right. We just had a pretty big scandal with that here in Texas. UT, a lot of the financial aid people were getting kickbacks from certain companies for, you know, subscribing to this loan or that. The same
collection
everywhere.
Well, thanks for the call. Let me go to the next caller, which should be, I appreciate your call, Denver. Tori in Louisiana.
Hey,
Tori.
Yep,
how you doing?
Andrew? Doing good.
Yes, this is Andrew.
All right, and my question, you know, I heard you guys talking about student loans, and I know Peter kind of gave a little video blog about how they've spiked, and I understand how, you know, it's kind of the same thing as the housing bubble, like the easy money, but, you know, I went to college, and I have the same problem, you know, the high student loans, and I was just curious, you know, what's a good plan? What are good people going to end up doing that have all this, you know, debt saddled on them?
Well, yeah, I don't have any. There's no easy solution to that answer to that question. I mean, I didn't graduate. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you know, and then what I was really thinking is, let's say all this, you know, hyperinflation. You know, I study it, I read about it, and it just seems like, you know, all this hyperinflation is supposed to happen. What would happen with the debt that people? I mean,
if you're a big debtor, this is the good news. This is a good news story. Hyperinflation is your best friend if you're a big debtor.
And unfortunately, I don't want to root against the good guys, you know, but it's like, what am I going to do?
Well, what are you going to do? You got to play the hand you're dealt.
That's right.
And, you know, that's why governments love inflation, because they're the biggest debtors out there. Who does inflation hurt?
And when you go to
inflation
college,
hurts...
Can't, wait, go ahead.
Yeah, I can't. Inflation hurts savers. Now, the problem is, what you need, and actually this is going to be the foundation. Peter and I are actually working on a book. It's going to come out next year, a cartoon book about economics, which is going to update a book that my father wrote about 25, 30 years ago, talking about the importance of savings in an economy and why savings essentially is the root cause or the mainspring of economic expansion. But in a situation of hyperinflation, who gets hurt? The savers get hurt because their savings gets wiped out. Who benefits? The borrowers, because whatever they get to repay their borrowing in cheaper money.
Right.
So governments love, that's why in Germany in the 1930s, the German government loved hyperinflation because they were able to pay back their creditors, I mean their war reparations from the First World War, in worthless money. So the good news, if this terrible thing happens with our currency, which we hope it won't, but the good news for someone who owns a lot of money as a result of a student loan and has difficulty paying it back, is through hyperinflation you can pay it back easier. I wouldn't discourage you from, if you're in school now and you're saying, I don't know if I can, you know, I think you got to look at it, you know, rationally. Will this completely wipe me out? Can I handle these kind of payments? And if you think that there's no way you can do it, then I think you got to, you know, factor that in. But I think over time, inflation will certainly, I mean, the playing field will be tilted in your direction, put it that way.
Right. And the thing is, you know, I was just like any other, you know, person, the Keynesian drones that we have walking around. So, I mean, I can definitely say one thing that came out of it is, you know, I learned about Austrian economics and stuff, and it's like things like this that happen now, it's like, you know, it's kind of a blessing in disguise that, you know, you kind of think about it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You got as Bill Murray said in Stripes, you got that going for you.
Right,
Let me move on to Bob in Pennsylvania. You got on
right,
for half hour. How you doing, Bob? Thanks a lot, Tori.
Bob. Andrew?
Yes.
Yeah, my question is regarding oil. It hit $82 today. If you're in the Jim Rogers camp, as I am, and you did it 6.7% a year in 15
years. It settled around 80, right?
It said 80, I thought it was 82, but anyway. Anyway, the question I have is, you know, Peter recommends the mining stocks. If oil goes to where a lot of the professionals think it's going to go, 200 or more, what does that do to the mining companies in terms of operation costs? And if we have a global currency crisis where everybody's printing money, fiat money, why wouldn't every citizen have physical gold or silver, whether the Perth Mint holds it or You hold it in your house, or you hold it in a vault somewhere. I don't understand why you'd have any paper securities, any paper investments at all regarding this worldwide printing of money. I'll listen to you.
Well, the Chinese government about a month ago came out and kind of exhorted its citizens to own gold. And I think that they maybe they're looking out for the best interests of their citizens, which might be a first. But I got to think that they're doing that because they anticipate that there's going to be a currency crisis. The question is whether or not your first question: what will happen to the profits of the energy of the mining companies if the price of oil goes way up? And clearly, that is an issue. I mean, last year, I mean, we think obviously the prices of what they're mining are going to go up to compensate for their higher production costs. But last year, at one point, the price of precious metals were falling. I mean, because there was a lag. If you go back in 2008, in the middle of the year, in between March and September, when between Bear Stearns and the rest of the crap hit and the you know what. The price of oil was spiking, once to $145 a barrel. At the same time, prices of gold was falling. So that combination just murdered the miners. I mean, they got crushed because their costs were going up a lot. And a lot, when you're talking about mining, you're talking about a very energy-intensive procedure. That's an issue. It's possible, but, the prices of metals are rising right now, and base metals as well. And the price of oil is... it's not going up nearly as fast as it did. I mean, last year there was a real spike. Now, if you look at the chart, it's a much more kind of a manageable trajectory. So I think that it will certainly provide a headwind to some of these companies. But again, the miners sold off so much. I mean, the gold miners, they might have been up 80 to 100% this year or more. But after they were down 80% last year, even if you buy a stock at 100 and it's down to 20, an 80% decline, and it goes up 100% or even 150%, well, now it's back up to 40 or 50, you still got a long way to go. So I think back to where you were, there's still room to run for these mining stocks as far as I'm concerned, and the energy might be an issue, but I don't think it's going to be anywhere near the issue it was last year, and I think the rise in metal prices will compensate. Now, the next part of your question has to do with why would anyone own anything that's denominated in a currency when all these currencies are going to get wiped out, and you shouldn't just own gold. And I think you got to think: well, are these countries going to race us to the bottom? I mean, are they just going to? I mean, if the U.S. dollar starts to devalue and turn hyperinflation, the question is: if the other countries start printing as much as we do, then we'll all be in the same boat. In which case, you'd say, "Yeah, okay, yeah, own only thing that's only own tangible assets."
But Mike, we don't. Just adding to that, before I forget to ask you this, if the banks, this has happened before, and in our country say, look, we're closed for the week, and you're tenfold up on your silver mining stock, and you can't get your money. That's my biggest concern with what's going on, especially with the seizure of the IRAs. I think that's going to happen with the 401ks and the SEPs.
I mean, there's nothing. That's made that tangible. I mean, I think that's a very, very, very low likelihood event. Now, if the situation comes where there is hyperinflation and all of a sudden if foreign countries don't follow us down a hyperinflationary path and a foreign currency stay relatively stronger and all of a sudden you're much wealthier than your neighbors because you have foreign stocks, I mean, is it possible that these kind of draconian measures will be imposed? I can't imagine that foreign governments would impose them, that the U.S. governments would impose them. I mean, it's possible, but I really don't think there's been much political will for that. I mean, that's pretty bad, and I don't think, I mean, a lot of people own stock these days. A lot of people own foreign stocks. It's not just, the lunatic fringe that own foreign stocks. To push that kind of legislation through, I just can't see it happening.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. I really appreciate your answers.
No problem. And to answer your question, I don't think the rest they're going to race us toward the bottom. At some point, their self-interest are going to come to the fore. We think as investors, you got to balance your portfolio. You do need to own some real things, but you also need to own some income-producing assets that are going to give you a revenue a yield that are going to grow with the international growth that we see in the global economy. So to do that, you got to own stocks. Okay, go to Mike in Ohio. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Mike,
how you doing?
How you doing? Enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
Hey, talking about a caller before the last one about playing your hand that you're dealt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Help me out here. I'm 44, okay?
Hey, I'm 44. No, I'm 40. Yeah, I'm 44.
Are you really?
After you're like 30, you stop remembering exactly, but I'm 44. Born at 65? Does that make me 44? Yes.
Yeah. Well,
okay, go ahead.
I have three kids also. My wife and I bring in about 80 together, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which in Ohio is okay. I imagine that's upper middle class, okay? We have about a $325,000 house that's paid for. Okay,
now that's nice.
This is where this inflation stuff is concerning me, because you're talking about how if you're in a lot of debt, how that actually benefits you, and if you're not and you're in cash, it's going to hurt you. And we have about 35 in the bank, and about 50 in a 401, like an IRA that was rolled over from where I used to work. Okay, in my 401, I've got about 60% that's sitting in a money market, 20% in a gold ETF, 10,000 that would be, and about 10 in Philip Morris or Altria, which pays a good dividend.
Yes, it does.
So, with the house, and I can go pretty big on a home equity loan. We were thinking about maybe buying a couple of rental properties because neither one of us have a pension. We can't rely on Social Security 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking maybe rental property, when we're older, might be good. Or if debt is better, if inflation and all that kicks in, should we take money out to do that?
This is what I would say. Nothing. It's nice that you own your property. That's great. In a hyperinflation, you own a real thing. You own a house.
Right.
That's not going to change with inflation. You'll still have the house.
Right.
And you can still use it and do what you want with it. The big question is, first of all, what you should do with your current money. And first of all, I would say you need to get more of that money out of the dollar. You can do that through, maybe you can do it with your own broker. Certainly you can do it here with your Pacific Capital. We'll get you out of the dollar. We'll give you more. We'll give you an income stream in non-dollar sources. And there certainly are, we think, good opportunities out there. I mean, cash is not the place to be. You got $40,000 in a money market. You're not getting compensated for that. You're getting basically zero interest, and you got a lot of risk,
right?
Because the dollar is going to go down. So you got to take care of that and get that out of dollars and get that out of money markets and keep yourself. I mean, you're getting a nice return on the Altria, but there are similar certainly 8-9% yielder out there in other places that are outside the dollar.
Right.
Now your bigger question is: sounded like you wanted to take money out, get a home equity loan, and use that money to buy rental properties. Invest. I would think, given the low rates of interest right now, as a society, we shouldn't borrow, more and more and more. People, rational decisions on an individual level can add up to irrational decisions on a societal level. But, I mean, given the fact how much, you could take out money as long as it's a manageable amount and realize that you can handle these payments. Interest rates are low. Handle these payments. What can you do with that money? Well, you can certainly get it out of the dollar. You could buy stocks, and you could buy an income stream in foreign stocks that I'm sure will pay what you're paying on for the loan. So you can be cash positive from that, and you can basically shield yourself away from the dollar as well. You can liquefy your hard asset and take some of it. I wouldn't do a lot of it, but if you want to take some small percentage out of your house so you can invest, I wouldn't invest more in U.S. real estate. I would invest outside the dollar so you can get true diversification because you already got some U.S. property. And that you can invest in a way that can pay back your interest and maybe can give you more diversification.
That's
something you got to think about.
That was what I was really going to get around.
I wouldn't make a huge bet, but it's something to think about.
Exactly. Okay, yeah.
Okay?
I appreciate that.
No problem. Okay, I'm going to go with Patrick in Oregon. Then I'll go to Matt in South Korea. You call him from South Korea. It's been on hold for 11 minutes, so it's going to be Patrick and then Matt. Hey, Patrick. How's it going?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Andrew, for taking my call.
No problem.
I have two questions related to the decline of the dollar. Given the continued and inevitable decline of the dollar, if I wanted to get into trading on the foreign exchange market, would you recommend I open one or more accounts in currencies other than U.S. dollars? In other words, like bite the bullet now and exchange my dollars so that all profits are in foreign currencies.
Well, you can do that. I mean, I can't speak for other brokerage firms what their policies are, but Here, if you wanted to open up an account and just put money in a foreign currency, and you open up, you have $10,000 or $100,000, and you want to put that into Swiss francs, we can put it in Swiss francs, and we can arrange it so that when you get, maybe you buy a bond or you buy an asset that has a dividend in Swiss francs, we can arrange it so all the, when the money comes in, it stays in Swiss francs, so it never becomes dollars. I mean, it's called a gloss account. It's pretty easy to set up. But is that your question? I think it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, but do you recommend, I guess what I'm saying is, biting the bullet now when the dollar is so low against other currencies, actually converting now on the front end and then having all that money then starting to accrue in profits in that foreign currency instead of doing all my trading in foreign and then U.S. dollars and then, you know, I might be making a profit, but I'm also the dollars.
Well, yeah, I mean, I see your question. I don't know how accurate, but you got to look at it this way. Do we think the dollar is going to be worth less next week than it's worth today? Yes. We think it's going to be worth less next month than it is today? Yes. Could it go up? Of course it could go up. You know, we can't be sure, but if we have to make a long-term bet, you know, that's what we do. And we're not really traders here. We don't have a trading mentality. We say, look, you could try to time this and get profits, you know, from day to day. And you could still, you know, get day-to-day profits by playing daily momentum moves. Yes, if you're really good and you know what you're doing, I guess you could do that. But we're saying it's like we just want to get out of the dollar because we think it's going down. I don't know what powder you're going to use, but maybe if you want to trade actively, you keep, you know, a small amount available that's liquid in dollars and you can trade, and the vast majority you stick in some other thing because you know that's where the momentum is.
Okay.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. The second question is, if our country's, you know, sort of economically going downhill, I mean, there's a chance that, I mean, when I read Peter's book, Crash Proof 2.0, I mean, it's pretty sobering. I mean, I'm wondering whether, if someone can live out of country for a time, do you think that's actually worth considering? And if so, are there certain countries out there from an economic standpoint do you think it would be worth looking into for riding out like a hyperinflation storm?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question. I mean, I personally think, you know, if you have the opportunity to live abroad, you probably should. Not because I think that, you know, you need to flee the United States or there's something wrong with, you know, there's something evil about the United States. I just think there's a lot of benefit for living overseas just as a human being. It gives you a great perspective, and it shows you how, you know, there are assumptions you've made about how society should be organized or how people should behave that you've always considered to be universal, and turns out they're not, and you get a lot of perspective. And, you know, you only live once, you might as well have more experience. That being said, you know, I wouldn't flee for economic reasons, but, I mean, clearly there is more growth abroad. You know, right now there is, even places like Australia, places like the Pacific Rim and China, Korea, Southeast Asia, are experiencing better growth. Would there be more opportunity for Americans? There probably is a lot of opportunity for Americans. That doesn't mean you should pick up and move, but if you heard of opportunities, I would explore them. I think those countries are going to do better over time because they have the ingredients necessary for sustained economic growth. You know, they have savings, they have low debt, they have high productivity gains, the things that we don't have, rising tide lifts all ships, so it'll be easier for you to probably succeed. I think as an American, you probably have other advantages working for you. So, I mean, I would not, if I were a young man, and I'm not, you know, I would certainly be interested in those opportunities. I wouldn't necessarily advise people just to pick up and leave because you've got to, because things are going to get so bad. You know, I don't necessarily see it as that dire. But let me go to Matt in South Korea. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing really good. Andrew, thank you for taking my call.
No problem. What time is it for you in South Korea?
It is 9:50 a.m. Thursday morning.
That's not so bad. It's a reasonable hour. Are you an American who lives in South Korea, or are you a South Korean who's a big fan of ours?
No, I'm an American who moved to South Korea.
Okay. How long have you been there?
I've been here for about 6 months or so.
6 months. Wow. And you concur with what I said earlier about opening up your horizon? Just kidding. You don't have to, we don't have to talk about that. And how is it that you came to South Korea? As a job opportunity?
Well, job opportunity, but mostly I'm here to finish up school and there's job opportunities. Most of my friends, believe it or not, happen to be Korean, so it just seemed like a very, it just seemed like okay. It made sense at the time to move to Asia in general. Mm-hmm. I think South Korea above Singapore or China or any place else. But to get to my question, I have a question about the Chinese currency, the RMB.
Yes.
And I know that it's a block currency, because even when I go to the airport, at the foreign exchange kiosk, you can't get it unless you're actually going to China. So I wondered if there were any ways that you could actually physically buy the renminbi without going on the black market.
I do not know the answer to that question. A wise man knows what he doesn't know. I don't know. I didn't know that you couldn't buy it. I know that they are. It's being, you know, it's being pegged. They're continuing to peg. Last year, the Chinese, I think, allowed the renminbi to appreciate it by about 20%. You know, wait, and since then, they've kind of slammed on the brakes. It's extremely well-regulated, well-managed currency in terms of its value. And maybe it's not surprising that they manage it at the border. I don't know why they would make those restrictions. Obviously, if you can't buy it, if you're not going to the country, that would tend to limit the demand, international demand for that currency, which would help them manage its rise. The more demand there was, the higher the currency would tend to rise. So perhaps by not selling it like that, they can at least take some pressure off of its rise. But Peter said all the time that he thinks that if there were no restrictions on the currency, and that
it would go to the moon.
Excuse me?
It would go to the moon.
Yeah, he thinks it would probably go up 4 or 5 times at the very least. Because again, it's everyone wants to buy things from China. And you need their currency to do it. So he would think it would go up 4 or 5 times, and that would make a huge difference in terms of the Chinese living standards. It would instantly make the Chinese economy much closer to the U.S. economy in terms of sheer size. Right now, I think the U.S. economy is $13 trillion annually GDP, and China is like 4, so we're 4 or 5 times bigger than them. But if the currency movements, it could, you know, close that gap in no time flat. Anyway, we're running out of time, so thanks for the call, Matt. And by the way, just a question for you. What is the perception of the United States at this point, economically speaking, from South Koreans that you speak to? Do you think that there's a feeling that the U.S. is a paper tiger and that the days of our economic preeminence have passed?
You are witnessing the end of the American empire, and there's sort of, South Koreans for many, many years had this obsession of learning English, and it's slowly starting to see it evolve, and everyone's starting to learn Chinese.
Huh.
Even the little kids, they're having to learn English and Chinese.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Also, the Chinese are trying to sell bonds that are denominated in renminbi. How would you get in on buying the bond?
It's interesting. I've heard they are selling renminbi bonds, and I actually want to look into that as a firm and see if we can sell some of those bonds. But they are selling renminbi bonds to private individuals. That policy was announced like a month ago. We should look into that and get back to you, because I think a lot of people would want to buy renminbi-dominated bonds. It seems like kind of a sure bet to me. That's a good question, and it's something we should talk about in a later show. Anyway, we're running out of time, so let me go to Joe in Colorado. Thanks a lot, Matt. Good. Nice hearing from you. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My question is very similar. It's regarding the Chinese currency. Pacific is recommending positions in Chinese securities. The money exchange is pretty flat. So, how do you take advantage of inflating U.S. dollar against that?
And in fact, most of the stocks in China that we buy are traded on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And in fact, the Hong Kong dollar is completely pegged there to the U.S. dollar. So yes, when you buy stocks in Hong Kong, you're not getting the benefit or the direct benefit of the currency exchange. We think that eventually the Hong Kong dollar will be pegged along with, you know, when the renminbi, you know, appreciates, the Hong Kong dollar is going to follow the renminbi. It's not going to follow the dollar. That's the way it's going to go. So yes, you might give up some gains in the near term, but you'll get them back in the long term. And more importantly, these companies that are in China, they might be earning their money in renminbi. They might be earning their money in other currencies locally. They're getting the benefits of their productivity. They're getting the benefits of rising currencies that are not dollars, but they're earning more as they sell to other nations that have different currencies. So you're in a stronger economy, and you're getting that benefit. You know, eventually you'll get the full currency benefit as well. You have to. But for now, you're not. So
what kind of time
we'll take,
are you thinking about?
Excuse me?
What kind of time...
don't know. It's hard to say. A couple, it's hard to say. I mean, who knows? You're asking people to read the mind of the Chinese Central Committee, the Politburo. They're making decisions based on a long-term time frame on political grounds. It's hard for me to say. But you know, those are the people that are calling the shots. It could be a couple of years. It could be a couple of months. It could be. I don't think it could be as long as 5 years or more. I mean, I think the world's changing, and I think they want to assert economic leadership and be around the world, and they're just being very patient about it. And given the fragility of their own economy, their own government, because they are not a democracy, they're a dictatorship that is susceptible to, you know, could be deposed through popular uprising. They've got to be very careful with what they're doing, and I think that's what they're doing. Anyway, let's go with Mike, our final caller. We're running out of time. Mike in North Carolina.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering about Atlantic Power. It's an energy trust. They've recently announced that they're going to switch to a corporate structure and early next year even list on the New York Stock Exchange. And I'm just wondering how that can affect dividends. Will that still serve as a strategy for hedging with foreign investments if they list on the New York Stock Exchange?
Yeah. Okay.
And can we expect dividends to drop? Or
sure. That? Now, Atlantic Power was I used to buy a lot. I mean, I'm not as familiar with it. I bought it a lot last year, and I think at one point it did drop a bit, but it came back. It's come back strongly. Yeah, it has come back. It fell off a cliff beginning of last year of 08. Anyone who bought it on the lows has done very well, given the fact that it's basically a utility, and the yield that it pays is pretty strong. There's a couple of different Chinese Canadian utilities. And right now it's paying about 9 cents a month Canadian, so that's about a dollar. It's paying yielding about 10%, which is pretty good given that yield out there for other sources. So I'm sure you're aware that there's a lot of changes going on in Canadian tax law preventing companies from, you know, requiring them to moving away from a trust structure. So that's probably what's causing them to change their structure. But listing on the New York Exchange doesn't make any difference, because if they list on the New York Exchange, you know, the New York Exchange price reflects the value of the currency. Sometimes there are stocks that list in both currencies. And when you look at the New York price compared to the Canadian price the same day, the changes are always a little bit different, because the changes for the New York one involve the currency changes, where the changes in the Toronto listing are only the pure changes in the actual stock. So the fact that they list here doesn't change the underlying value of the company, which is based on their own currency.
Okay,
so I wouldn't worry about that. And it looks like Atlantic's doing pretty well. So I mean, I don't have a lot of clients that have it, but it looks like it's whatever the news was, the market liked it. So anyway, thanks for your call, Mike. We got 30 seconds left. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is Andrew Schiff in New York City, and hopefully I'll be with you again soon. As I said, Peter is going to go for shiftforsenate.com if you're interested in supporting his candidacy, Schiff for Senate. Visit us at europac.net, www.europac.net, and we look forward to speaking with you again next week. If you want, you can call us at 800-727-7922. That's 800-727-7922. And happy fall, happy Halloween. Boo.